she inspires, educates, and informs. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. I am Gina Murphy-Darling, and you are indeed listening to Mrs. Green's World, an inspirational and informative place where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. Thanks so much for joining us and for thinking with us and for being a part of our mission and vision. And a special thanks to the sponsor of this show and a great partner of Mrs. Green's World, the Chapman Automotive Group. They are indeed committed to doing their share and showing they care about their employees, their community, and the environment. To learn more about them, you can visit them at chapmantucson.com, and I hope you do. Now we're going to be talking about the public face of Seafood Watch, and believe me when I say we have just the person to educate us about just what that means. So please join me in welcoming Ryan Bigelow, Program Engagement Manager for one of my favorite places on the planet and for millions of others as well, and one of the most important programs that I believe you might ever hear about. Ryan gets to manage the program for engagement for Seafood Watch at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. And the Seafood Watch program, if you're not familiar with it, which would be rather shocking to me, but that's what Mrs. Green's World is for, it helps consumers and businesses make choices for a healthy ocean. And as we know, the oceans do indeed impact everything we do, including the air we breathe. So, Ryan, it's so great to have you here. And I have lots of questions, and I'm sure you have lots of answers.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, I just want to make a comment before we get started. I was fortunate enough to attend several sustainable seafood institutes at the Monterey Bay Aquarium, and the experience was honestly transformative in the Mrs. Green's World journey. Not only was it beyond impressive and well-run and at the Monterey Bay Aquarium, which nobody really suffers when they go there, it left its mark on me because of the magnitude and scope of the things that you all are involved in. So I just want to, you know, kind of honor you all and Julie and everybody there that continues to raise the consciousness about the health of our oceans in such a meaningful way. So that's my own commercial for the Monterey Bay Aquarium. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Oh, it's just, you know, it's to me, it's way better than Disneyland because it's living, thinking, breathing, interactive, and all about hope and possibility. So I did stay, as I said, I attended several years ago, and it's certainly the Seafood Watch program is really alive and well, even where Mrs. Green's World is headquarters. And as I'm sure you know, the Arizona Sonoran Desert Museum is an active partner. Numerous restaurants participate in our city. Mainers and the Hotel Congress is a proud partner of us. So bring us up to date or up to speed of the sustainable seafood movement today. Where is it? What's happening?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think for most people, when they think about the sustainable seafood movement, they probably think about an app or even a paper pocket guide that they might have received at the
right.
Store museum. Or
I do. I used to give them out at all of my events. I had the little app and used to give them out to everybody.
Yesterday. It is. Well, we continue to do it, but you're absolutely right. That was where we started. That's our roots. We've given out nearly 60 million of those, and
wow.
Nearly 2 million people downloaded the app. But what, you know, and that's great, but I think, and you've alluded to it several times, the Sustainable Foods Institute is a good example. That was an event we ran in years past where we brought in the media, because the more and more the media want to tell the story, and they're
right.
interested. And that wasn't the case 18 years ago when we got started. People didn't really understand what sustainability was, and they were less interested in ocean issues. Today, because of everything from slavery to traceability issues, the general public is more and more concerned about what they're eating from the ocean. And so we have that interest. And that's great, both at the public level and at the level of the press. So what we've seen more and more is the shift towards from consumers to work more with businesses. It's one thing to ask a consumer to go into a store and ask questions about the fish they're buying, but if they can't get answers, then that's not a helpful not a helpful thing for them to do. So what we've really been doing is working with businesses, and we have partners all across the United States, you know, Whole Foods, et cetera, others who make commitments on their end. So if you walk into that store, it's enough to know that they've made a commitment, and you don't have to do the dirty work of trying to figure out exactly what species you're buying, exactly how it was caught, where it was caught, et cetera. So that, we think, is really the future, is working with businesses to make whole-scale change.
And I couldn't agree with you more, because what people want, let's be honest, what consumers want, please make it easy for me. I want to do the right thing, but make it easy. I just have to comment, I went to this big annual meeting for an incredible organization here called Visit Tucson yesterday, and the guest speaker was a guy named Jay Bear. And this speaks to your point about the, you know, the little Seafood Watch brochure that I used to give out. I mean, the world is changing, and he said, the millennials, they're not carrying seafood, you know, Seafood Watch, little tiny, I'm at a loss for words here, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
They're, if it's not on the app, it isn't. Basically, yeah. That's what he said. He said, so the consumers, myself included, I have one thing, and it's a smartphone. So you're so on that bandwagon, and that's, of course, where you need to be. What about your changing relationships, or are there major changes with governments and fishermen and other NGOs? I mean, we haven't had you on, I don't think, for like maybe 5 years. So
yeah.
What's changing in those arenas?
Absolutely. Well, you know, when you're an environmental NGO, you work with the people who are working in your field. So in our case, that's fishermen and farmers. You work very closely with governments, and then there are all the other NGOs that occupy your space one way or another. And when we were starting out, there were different NGOs with different messages. Fishermen and the industry in general weren't necessarily on board with what we were doing. There wasn't this push for sustainability, but all of that has changed. Maybe a good example of that is the groundfish fishery on the west coast of the United States. So when you talk about groundfish, you're talking about rockfish, you're talking about flounders, et cetera, anything that's living close to the ground in the rocks there. And 15 years ago, that was declared a national disaster. But at that point, NGOs, fishermen, and governments came together to work on a solution, and now everything south of the Canadian border is either a Seafood Watch best choice, our green recommendation, or a good alternative, our yellow recommendation. Both of those fall into what we would call a buy recommendation, you know, that as a consumer or business, you can feel okay buying those products. So that really illustrates the difference, that we've moved into this age of working together, collaboration, and it's done good things for both the oceans and fishing communities, frankly.
You know, I didn't want to go into the app a lot, but would you just quickly explain to our listeners what the apps does in terms of its recommendations and those categories that you know, it's kind of like my version is fine to eat, you know, maybe sketchy, don't eat it, and then please don't ever eat this. I know that's the layman's term. So what are the recommendations that you know, come out when it comes to eating certain kinds of seafood?
Yeah, absolutely. So Seafood Watch uses a very simple, at least when we're speaking to consumers, we use a very simple stoplight traffic system. So you're going to go green, yellow, red.
I love
green
it.
That's as easy as it gets, right? And of course, for the science wonks out there, that is all underpinned by peer-reviewed science. It's all very transparent. You can get on, you can see the numeric scores if you want to. But if you just want to buy good products, then you just start in the green. This is a very little impact on the environment, be a wild product or a farm product. The species are healthy, they're not using a lot of chemicals, et cetera, et cetera. Then when you get into the yellow, you start to get into this broad swath of products that there are a couple issues. We wouldn't necessarily say that at its current point it is sustainable, but they are doing a relatively good job, and hopefully they're improving towards the green. That's always the goal, is to get things into the green. You step out of that category and you get into the red. Now, the red are our avoid items, the things that there are too many impacts on the environment, and we ask consumers and business partners to not buy those items.
And I don't want to say bold. Brave is the word I'm looking for. I mean, it's quite a stand because people love their seafood. So to me, the leadership that you provide, it's probably one of the things that impressed me the most because it does impact industries, but you do have to take a stand. It's one of the things I love. So kind of along those lines, one of the things that comes up a lot for me, whether it's in energy, I mean, there are a myriad of issues that people approach me about. And it's always like, so, and I want to use like a voice like, so why should we do this if they're not doing it in China and India, which to me is not the solution. It's like, what's your moral compass? What should we be doing as leaders in sustainability? So what are you doing in terms of places like Southeast Asia and Brazil and Chile and countries that have, you know, they have farms and they have massive consumption of seafood? What are your collaborations in that area, if any?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And just I'll just start out by echoing your point about the need to lead.
Yes, I love it. I'm going to write that down. That's what it is. Yeah, what do you care what they're doing? We should be leaders.
We need to be leaders. That said, in the United States, we import 90% of the seafood we eat.
Holy smokes.
Our fisheries are very well managed here in the United States. I think something well over 90% of all the fisheries in the United States get either a green or yellow recommendation from us. So we're doing a good job here, but we're not. There's not enough fish there to feed us. We're importing quite a bit from overseas. So what does that mean? It means that we need to work on the ground with organizations both to guide what they're eating there in those countries and also to help them develop sustainable options for them to sell to us, because many of them are. Maybe the best example of that is shrimp. The vast majority of the shrimp that we eat here in the United States is farmed in Southeast Asia. Now, what's been getting in the press quite a bit frequently is slavery issues associated with farmed fish. And then there's, of course, all of the environmental issues that people have come to associate with farmed shrimp. So we're on the ground there helping farmers develop sustainable products to bring to the United States. Now, I'm particularly interested in this work because I think there's been, within the environmental community, a tendency for people from the global north, if you will, America, other rich countries, to go to countries, developing nations in particular, and say, this is the way that you should do whatever you're doing to keep it sustainable. And often that doesn't take into account the livelihoods, and it doesn't take into account the culturally important parts of the work they do. And often those, if you have that top-down approach to conservation, it's often not very effective. So I'm particularly proud of this work because while we are there sharing our science, working with fishermen and scientists and government agencies on the ground in these different countries, particularly in Southeast Asia, our role is only guidance. So there's a panel of people who have voting rights around this work. We don't have voting rights. We sit there, we provide that guidance, but we are not a decision maker there. So it's a, you know, colloquially this sort of colonial environmentalism, if you will. We're not doing that. And so for me personally, I'm very proud of this work. So that's one thing we do on the ground. Another thing we do on the ground is we've started to bring together organizations like ours in other countries that are providing ratings to their public. So we work with 12 nations throughout the world, or I'm sorry, 12 organizations that provide recommendations to a variety of nations, and we're working to see if we can come together on a scientific vocabulary around what does it mean to have an environmentally responsible product, and we're also providing our science to them in case they want to use it. So if you want to start Seafood Watch China, for lack of a better word, what would you need to do to be successful with that, and how can we help?
You know, it's huge. And while you're talking, I'm sitting here thinking about, you know, Mrs. Green's World is 10 years old, and it may sound ridiculous and like I have a firm grasp on the obvious, but the interconnectivity of us as a species and us as planet Earth, it just comes home to roost in my world so many, many times, because everything that happens out there or over there or down there has an impact on the planet, which then in turn has an impact on us. And you certainly touched on the complexity of it. It's not like you just do it. There's people's livelihoods. That's how they have fed their family for generations, for centuries. So, you know, I've always been very stand in awe of the comprehensive and lack of blame from the Seafood Watch and Monterey Bay as leaders. You really get it that it's complex and there aren't always simple solutions as much as we'd like to believe there are. So kudos. Can you tell, Ryan, that I'm kind of like high on seafood on Monterey Bay and Seafood Watch? I mean, I really did learn a lot. And I would love you to share some of the success stories, because I know when I went to this, you know, to the food institutes, there were incredible, heartening success stories, and especially in this time, where if you're like me, I don't even watch the news too much anymore because it takes my energy. I'd rather make the news and be a disruptor for good. But I know you have to have some success stories to pump us up a little bit. Good news.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, I think you make a really good point about the complexity of the issue. So if you don't mind, I'll tie that into the story.
I would love you to tie it in because it's so big.
It really is. And I think a good example, again, the West Coast groundfish that I discussed earlier, where you have, you know, just to set the stage one more time, a fishery that's in very bad straits, but through the collaboration of NGOs, not just us, mind you, we weren't even necessarily the leaders on that, but many NGOs coming together with the fishermen who had very great, you know, were pushing on that as well, and government, you know, you now have healthy fisheries. So that's great. So that's the success story. But it's not done there, because now you have a sustainable fishery, but because it for so long there was no fishery, the fishermen are having a really hard time getting that product to the public. So if you don't have, you know, we don't have canneries anymore on the West Coast.
Right.
We don't, many of the ports that where they want to bring in their fish no longer have ice. They might not be able to buy gas easily right where they want to dock. And so how do you take that product and get it to chefs? And this is a great product. It's usually, you know, Americans, we're not very adventurous when it comes to seafood. We want it to be effectively like a chunk of white protein is kind of what we're going for. All of these fish fall into it. They're great in like fish and chips, things like that. So how do you remind the public that we have these really cool local items that they could be eating, right? So we're doing quite a bit of work around that, both at Seafood Watch and at the Monterey Bay Aquarium proper. So that's an exciting area where we have that first component of it, the environmental component, pillar of sustainability is there. Now we have to work on the economic component, that people component, if you will, when you talk about the three Ps. So that's exciting. Another area of success, and again, I'm jumping back to our work in Southeast Asia, where we've set up this framework for how you can take a farm that is not doing very well, frankly, and get it out of our red and into our yellow at least, and then eventually, hopefully, into the green. We've had the first farms who have followed this framework and have moved out of the red and into the yellow.
That is, like, I want to ring the bell. Those are big successes. They're not little. I mean, it's the ripple effect. So, yes, do tell us about those. Moving from red to yellow is a good day.
Well, and I think it's particularly important in that part of the world because, again, the most popular seafood in the United States is shrimp. And, again, we get most of it from Southeast Asia, and there are serious issues there, both on the environmental front and, again, on how we're impacting populations of people. And so to get those farms out of the red, to get them away from having to feed their farms with products that were caught by slaves, those are big, powerful steps forward. And, you know, it's an interesting sort of dilemma to be in right now. One of the reasons I think we're getting so much attention to sustainable seafood now is because of the serious articles that have been in places like the New York Times or the Guardian about the humanitarian
yes.
impacts of our
yes. yes.
lust for
right.
cheap shrimp, right? And so, of course, we don't want to see slavery. That's what, you know, that's the most heinous thing I can imagine. But it has really driven people's attention to this product, to this issue, rather. And so we're working very closely. That's another big change I think you'll see is that our definition, the entire movement's definition of what sustainability is, now includes a social component. And 18 years ago, when we were just trying to grasp how we were possibly going to write enough recommendations to cover all the fisheries in the world, the human impacts weren't something we were considering, and now we do. So that's a big, big step forward. And I would say, even though obviously that's a huge problem we haven't fixed yet, just the fact that we're now mature enough to handle that, to look at it, is a win.
Just the fact that you're talking about it, and I have to go back. I got interviewed yesterday for a news article because it's our 10-year anniversary, and the reporter that interviewed me was asking what are some of the biggest changes in the 10 years, not necessarily as it relates to the climate or climate change or that. I said the biggest and most encouraging component to me is the conversation around social justice, that you cannot have a sustainable planet without having a socially just planet. So I'm covering many more stories about that. I'm so glad that you brought it up because in the fashion industry, and when you use the word slavery, to any consciously living human being, it kind of gets their attention. I mean, maybe not for everybody, but certainly in the United States, there are millions of us that really don't want to contribute to slavery anywhere on the planet. So it's a great, I'm so thrilled that you brought it up. Okay, believe it or not, everybody, first break. What the heck? Ryan Bigelow, Program Engagement Manager, Seafood Watch, Monterey Bay Aquarium. So much more to share. Please stay here with me. We'll be back in 30 seconds.
Join us for a new on-demand podcast every week at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio or SoundCloud mobile apps. We are a proud member of the iHeartRadio, Glimmerglass, and Speak Up networks. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Stay in touch with information about healthy living, sustainability, contests, and events by signing up for our e-newsletter on our website. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. But right now, back to Mrs. Green.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and you are listening to Mrs. Green's World, where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. And so many good things we're being given the opportunity to think about for this hour. Thanks for listening. We're talking about the public face of Seafood Watch. The Seafood Watch program helps consumers and businesses make choices for a healthy ocean. Joining me for this hour is Ryan Bigelow, Program Engagement Manager, Seafood Watch at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. And Ryan has a big job, to say the least. He oversees all of the public-facing aspects of the Seafood Watch program, including the consumer pocket guides, their website, social media, consumer-facing special events, and their network of more than 125 conservation partner organizations. And Ryan, I hope I got that number right. You know, sometimes when you Google, there's been a big update that didn't come up at the top of the search. But what I just shared lets people know that you've got a lot going on over there and around the world.
Yes, it's, and actually we now have over 200 conservation partners.
See, I'm so glad I asked that because
it's big.
Yeah, and growing, which to me is the part of the encouraging news, and I'm glad that I remembered to ask that. So what about, what are you worried about? What species should consumers try to avoid if you feel comfortable saying that? I mean, I'm allergic to fish, so I am absolutely clean in this conversation, so you can say anything to me, but what are species of concern to you?
So, you know, this is probably the most common question we get, and it's a really good one, and I think it speaks to a couple of different things. I think it speaks first to some of the complexity around it, right? There are certain species where, depending on how it was caught and farmed, it might be a best choice, and somewhere they're in a void because for issues, right? They're caught in a bad way, or they're caught in they're catching too many, what have you. So that gets complicated. But if you're talking about blanket, please do not eat this species. I would say there are three that jump to mind right off the top of my head. The first one is bluefin tuna.
Okay.
And that is, you know, you're mostly going to see that in the United States. You're going to see that in your sushi restaurants. And you just, it's something, you know, those populations are about 3% of their historical biomass. There's only 3% of the total weight left, if you will, in the water. And so that's a real issue, and we ask that people avoid those completely. The other one that when you're at the sushi shop or ask you avoid are unagi or eel. Again, I know for many people, myself included, who are sushi lovers, that those are hard things to say goodbye to, but if you're just going to do one thing or avoid one species while you're there, I would choose one or hopefully both of those and not eat those. And then finally, orange roughy is one that is still not back to where we need it to be, and that was something that I would absolutely say, regardless of how it's caught, you just don't eat it.
So let me ask you about orange roughy, and I could be totally wrong, and feel free to correct me on the air. I have no investment in being wrong or right. So, I mean, I care very much about being right, but I think, not being a seafood eater, that there was a time when orange roughy was in wild abundance. I mean, when I was growing up, nobody ever heard of it. Then it got very popular. What is the history of that particular fish?
So orange roughy was one of those species that is sort of a victim of its own fame.
Got it.
You're absolutely right to say that it
got
was.
It.
Well, as most wild populations were, it was there was a large number of them in the water. And then they caught on in popularity, and they had a very high value, so that you can make quite a bit of money by catching them. And they are frequently in areas of the world that weren't well managed, or so it was sort of this free for all Wild West scenario where they were catching quite a few of these fish, more fish than they should have. There wasn't enough oversight, and so now they're mostly caught in New Zealand, but. They're just not doing well. There's some good management in place, some acceptable management, but the impact on other species, on the habitat there because of the trawling, the deep sea corals that are there, it's just not worth eating it. And again, it's like bluefin tuna. The flavor appeals very much to most people across cultures, and so they're a victim of their own tastiness too, if you will. Not to be light about it, but
that's a perfect story though. It is. It was so good. And I mean, when I was a kid, I never heard of it. And I was surrounded by seafood eaters. I grew up, on the Jersey Shore. But orange roughy was not on the menu, I'm telling you. And then all of a sudden it was big. And then I remember probably from going to the Sustainable Foods Institute, you know, like you said, a victim of its own success.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. One other interesting thing about orange roughy that is sort of emblematic of the seafood industry overall, you know, orange roughy, a name that you might have heard before was popular was slimehead.
Oh my God. And fortunately, I never did hear of that.
Well, and it's one of these things where they've changed the name to make it more appealing to customers. So
yes.
Plain sea bass, many people know this, is actually Patagonian toothfish, you know, neither a sea bass nor Chilean, but
are you serious?
Yes. And so that's where you see,
I did not know that.
Yeah, anything with the word bass in it really appeals to the American palate, and so you'll see a lot of that. Snapper is another one where people use that name very fluidly,
right,
if you will.
Right. Oh my gosh, that cracks me up. Chilean sea bass is what?
Patagonian toothfish.
Nobody would order that. I'm sorry that I didn't know that in my research, but anyway, that adds a lot of humor to this show, and people like to laugh. Oh, my goodness. Okay, I have to write that down. Because I know friends will order it. And I want to ask you first, before I go into it, I think I read in the research I've done to try and be more current, you know, it blows me away with the Americans how we're on our never-ending quest to make things easy and overpackaged and shipped and blah, 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 blah. I mean, I have friends that get Pet of the Month Club, and there's This of the Month Club, and Joy of the Month Club, and Toys of the Month Club. But one of the things that has come up on my radar that sounds kind of good is the whole Blue Apron movement, where it's a meal kit. Did I read that you're participating with them in some intentional way?
Yes, we are partners. We are official partners of Blue Apron. So that's been a very powerful relationship with us.
Good. Good.
So the interesting thing about Blue Apron, and there's a couple really good things going on there. One, and this is sort of taking off my Seafood Watch hat, but just speaking more generally about people, it feels like we've sort of lost our connection to cooking food.
Yes.
It's difficult to do. I know. Let me limit it. I'm guilty of this.
Yes, guilty here. Guilty here.
So Blue Apron, it fills that niche nicely in that it arrives, you know exactly what you want, the hard prep on the fish is done, but it's still a process because they're good meals, right? They're not simple.
Right.
They're very delicious. And so there's some work that goes into that. So you have to interact with your food, which I think is a good thing. Additionally, if you are paying for a product to be sent to your home and you're paying for the experience of cooking, then you obviously care about your food. And so it's the perfect audience for us to talk about sustainability. And Blue Apron's been very excited about that. They've been willing to share our message inbox, which is great for us to reach more people. And of course, we're a nonprofit, and we're not selling anything to them, but we are trying to get them on board with
really important
sustainability.
Yes, yes.
And Blue Apron has even gone further to help us engage with fisheries and farms in Southeast Asia to learn more about what they can do to take those farms out of the red and into the yellow or even the red, or even the green, rather, sorry. So that's an interesting new model. We've done it a few other times as well, but really taking these industry leaders to troubled fisheries or farms and having them say, here's how we can support you in your efforts to become sustainable, which moves far away from the avoid message of, no, we're not going to touch your product. It's, we understand you have problems now, but we're willing to help. And so Blue Apron has been a really powerful partner in that.
I am so glad I brought it up. And it does, it's another one of those things where, sure, we don't partner with you because, you know, you stink, you're not sustainable. It doesn't help. It doesn't help at all. How can we partner together for a mutually beneficial solution? Not to mention you benefit, Blue Apron benefits, and the people eating the fish benefit. So it's one of those multipliers that makes me, you know, gives me hope on days where I'm looking for all the hope I can get. Let's be honest.
Yeah. Well, I agree 100%. And I would say, just to be in all fairness, Blue Apron, they're the biggest meal kit company in the United States, and they are a partner, but HelloFresh as well, the biggest in the world, second biggest in America, they're also a partner. And so
I'm glad you brought them up too.
Yeah, so that's, you know, we have these partners now who really have the ability to move people and to speak. They're not just selling food, they're selling a lifestyle, they're selling a certain mindset about sustainability. So in the past, it was really Whole Foods who was pushing that, and they continue to do that. But HelloFresh, Blue Apron, Disney, these places that you might not imagine who are on board promoting this message, and it's been very helpful.
You know, when you talk about quotable quotes, and I mean, I'm going to be 67 years old in a couple of months, and it's really sad to say, I think in hashtags or quotable quotes now, my brain has adapted, but that's really a phrase, not just selling food, selling a mindset. It's really important and impactful. And, you know, I can already say right this. I rarely say this on the air, but what a great guest with great answers. So I didn't know anything about HelloFresh. And what I was thinking about and cracking up about is, before you know it, the drone will be bringing your supper to you hot outside from Amazon. You just call up Amazon and, you know, okay, we'll be there in about 30 minutes and the little drone will come by and drop your hot, fresh seafood off.
Yes.
You know, it's not beyond the realm of possibility, and Amazon certainly is going to rule the world. They'll just go down to our local Whole Foods, you know, put in the order and send the drone out. It'll be like carrier pigeons of days past. So let's imagine that. Drones don't use a lot of, they don't commit, you know, put a lot of carbon into the air. So I'm okay with that.
Okay.
You know, I just want to, this is kind of a weird comment to throw in, but one of the most challenging interviews I ever did, but interesting, you know, my husband is a partner in the business with me and my board op, was Dr. Sylvia Earle. And I want to let the guest go. I don't want to interrupt you. I want you to answer as long as you can. So James said to me, you should have just asked her, so what do you think, and let her go. And that's not a put down. I mean, she is so passionate, so knowledgeable, has so much to say. She's a little stick of dynamite, and they call her the blue heart of the ocean. And she said, we should not eat seafood at all. Nobody should ever eat another fish from out of the ocean. And I liken that to my stand on beef. You know, I'm not going to stop eating beef forever, probably. I'm working on it. But I eat far less beef. Like, we went from being maybe, you know, three times a week to now once a month, maybe, we eat beef. Because, you know, from my filter, it has the biggest carbon impact because of all of the bad things that are happening to the rainforest and blah, blah, blah. What do you say to consumers? My friends that eat shrimp, they're not giving up their shrimp. Do you have any words of wisdom? Would you counsel people to cut back or just be more conscious? Or what would you say? You have a big job, and you certainly hold a lot of credibility with me.
Oh, thank you. You know, I would actually like to jump back to Sylvia Earle first, but then come back to your question, if you don't mind, because Sylvia Earle is one of my personal heroes.
Rock star.
Like, oh, she's amazing.
Oh, my gosh. I want to meet her so much. You have no idea.
Yeah, well, it's a moving experience. Trust me, she's an amazing person. I would say, when you're looking at solutions, you know, the oceans, between climate change, our fishing, the plastics, you name it. The oceans are really the heart of our world, and they are being pressed on all sides. That is true. And so one possible solution to that is the one that she puts forth, which is don't eat seafood.
Right.
She's not wrong that would do some good things for the ocean. So, you know, and obviously she knows much more about it than I do. From our stance, however, my concern is what I see in my work, and this is anecdotal, I admit it, but when people care about seafood but they don't have enough information to make a choice, they'll say, well, I'm not going to get the salmon because I don't know if it's, you know, if it's a good choice or whatever, what have you.
Right.
And they end up getting the beef.
Ugh.
Or they end up getting the chicken, right?
Yes.
So it's not...
That's worse.
Yes. Well,
In some ways, how can you say...
We're not beef watch, we're just seafood watch, so I can't speak to that, but
right.
In a lot of ways, yes, pardon me, was, wait a minute, no, that's not better, right? And so if we had a scenario where people were eating less protein overall, which I, especially in the United States, I mean, that's not even an opinion, we eat too much protein, my perfect world would be us eating less protein. And if you look at sort of the pie, if you will, of what you're consuming, the percentages, the protein pie, a larger piece of it would be fish, but you would be eating less protein overall.
Got it.
I think that's the direction I would suggest we go in.
It's a great answer. It's really a great answer.
But then goes into your next question, the question you posed about what do you say to these people who just don't want to give up shrimp or maybe aren't all that interested. I don't think, this is another thing that I've learned over time, is that I can tell people to do things and they're going to push back, right? That's not the way to do it. I think your intro quote about getting people to think but not telling them what to think is exactly right, though it took me a decade to get to that point in my own thinking. I can't make you do it, you know, and there's nothing I'm going to say that's going to convince you. What I can do is get as much information out there as possible, make it as clear and transparent as possible, and then work with businesses so that, let's say you don't care, you have no interest, or frankly, the average American consumer, their shopping basket by value, only about 5% of it is seafood. We're not buying a lot of fish. So if you don't even have the bandwidth, if you're tired, you have children, you have work, whatever it may be, just go to a partner. That's why we work with businesses, so you don't even have to think about it. So you don't even have to have that awkward conversation with your friends because you know they bought their shrimp at Whole Foods or they're buying their seafood through Blue Apron or one of our other 300-plus partners. So you know you're getting a sustainable product and your friend didn't have to think about it.
It's, you know, to me, it is the point. It is the point and it is the quintessence of the Mrs. Green's World mission. Just think about it. And live consciously, and you will then make better choices about all of these things. And you are spot on. As a consumer, I have now brands that I know I can trust, that I have vetted, that I don't have to worry about. So what do you think I buy over and over and over? Because I did my homework. It only took one time. And, you know, we all have guilty pleasures, and mine is bacon. And every once in a while, I want bacon. And I want to know that smart, adorable, you know, pig was not crated. And, you know, so it's like I can once in a while eat guilt-free bacon. And your point is so well taken, especially on this end of it's not even everything in moderation, because we made drastic changes in our, you know, our consumption of beef. I think that's the biggest one. And you're right. It's, I love that you said we're not beef watch, we're seafood watch. That was another cleverism from our Ryan Bigelow. But It's the looking in that direction that I think is more important. And kudos to Sylvia Earle. I mean, she grew up like two exits down from me on the Garden State Parkway. I wish I had bumped into her when I was in my younger years because she's done it all. I mean, I can't wait to hear that she's going to space because she probably will someday. But anyway, go ahead.
Just put it on your bucket list to meet her. She is a powerhouse.
I just really want to. And I met someone at the Oceans Night at the Desert Museum that had just come back from a conference with her. It's a friend of mine that's doing incredible work here. And she was at the Desert Museum for World Oceans Night. And Sylvia Earle came up. She goes, oh my God, Gina, I got to meet her. She is all that. You just want to follow her around and listen to everything she says. So she has that wow power and so passionate. We have a short break coming up again. I have, you know, a page and a half of questions left, but I'd like to talk briefly when we come back one thing about what's happening with the Sustainable Food Institute. We got an email that it is on hold. And then, you know, talk a little bit more about what you're working on more specifically now and where you're going. What's coming up? What are some of the big surprises that we can look at? And if we have time, can we talk a little bit about aquariums in general, Ryan? Because we opened a dolphinarium in Phoenix, and I was part of the protest of it, you know, marching to not have it open. It's not the Monterey Bay Aquarium. So some of that to cover in the next time will fly. Everybody stay here with me. Ryan Bigelow from Seafood Watch at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. We'll be right back. 30 seconds.
Mrs. Green's world's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thanks for being a part of it. We are talking this hour about the public face of Seafood Watch. The Seafood Watch program helps consumers and businesses make choices for a healthy ocean. Their recommendations help all of us choose seafood that's fished or farmed in ways that have less impact on the environment. Joining me for this hour is Ryan Bigelow, Program Engagement Manager, Seafood Watch at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. And as I said earlier, he oversees all the public-facing aspects of Seafood Watch program, including the Consumer Pocket Guide, an app, I assume, their website, social media, consumer-facing special events, and their network of more than 200 conservation partners. Ryan, thanks so much for being here and for being such a great guest. This is making me so frustrated how fast the time is going. So let's get to it. What's happening with the Sustainable Foods Institute? You have pressed pause.
Yes, well, and there's unfortunately, it's a very boring, well, it's an interesting story, but there's no secret there. I don't know if you know this, but the aquarium has been around for 34 years. And no one ever quits. Everyone loves to work here. And so we're just now starting to see our first staff start to retire.
That's happening all over. I mean, it really is.
Yeah, no one ever leaves. They've been here since before the doors opened because it's just a great place to work. People believe in the mission. And so it just so happened that our marketing team, our amazing marketing team who really leads that work, they're filling a bunch of positions this year. And we just didn't have the bandwidth. So it was there's no deep meaning there or anything like that. We're working and considering it for next year. We just had to get staff up and running this year.
But what a great answer. It's great to know that because it's a lot of work. And you have all these press people asking so many questions. And I think we'll probably stay on the list, Mrs. Green's World, because now after this interview, I'm so reignited in terms of coming back and doing it. So that's enough about that. What about, what was the next question I wanted to ask? Can we talk a little bit about aquariums in general?
Sure.
Yours is the Oscar-winning, award-winning Gold Star of aquariums, and I haven't been to a lot of many, the one in Chicago I have been. So what are you doing in terms of working with other aquariums, and, what are some common issues or campaigns? You can't put it all in one mix either.
Yeah, and I think, there's a couple different levels to that answer, and so I'll start just very quickly with what Seafood Watch does. We have let me step back a little bit. I don't know how much your listeners know about the zoo and aquarium world in general, but for the most part, it's not a business that you get rich doing. For many institutions to have an organization like Seafood Watch, they'd love to do it. They love their animals. They want to promote protecting them in the wild, but they don't have the funds to do it. And we know as the Monterey Bay Aquarium, while we might be very locally famous and people nationally might know our name, we don't have the same local name that a local zoo or aquarium might have.
Right.
So what we've done is we've taken the Seafood Watch program, the pocket guides, the app, the signage, the messaging tools that we use, we'll package those up and we'll give those to zoos and aquariums for free. We even put their logo on the guides if they'd like. And so that's they get a plug-and-play conservation program ready to go. We get a broader audience of people hearing the sustainability message. They benefit. Oceans benefit. It's good for everybody.
Right. Win-win-win.
So
win.
Exactly. So that's what we do from the Seafood Watch side of things. But I think sort of what you're probably getting at here is there's been a real change in how people look at zoos and aquariums. You know, zoos and aquariums over the last 15 years have moved from, hey, we keep animals in cages for your entertainment to we are bastions of conservation, you know, where there are species in zoos that no longer live in the wild, et cetera. And so that's been changing, while at the same time consumers are less and less willing to stomach, for example, cetaceans in captivity, things like that, so your whales, et cetera. And so it's a tough time to be a zoo and aquarium in that way. But, if, for example, the Monterey Bay Aquarium, the only mammals we keep in captivity are the otters, and they're all rescues, right? So we are, we bring in otters all the time, and they've usually lost their mother either through some sort of boating accident or to a shark. We raise them up, release them back to the wild if they're physically capable, and the ones we keep are the ones that, for whatever reason, have medication, can't go back in the wild. So yes, that's sort of where the zoo and aquarium world stands. We're trying to find that, you know, you see institutions across the country trying to come to terms with this new reality. What does it mean to take these very popular animals off exhibit? It's an interesting time. I think overall, while there's some growing pains for many institutions, you're going to see better zoos and aquariums with better conservation messages. So I think it's a good movement overall.
You know, and it's raised awareness. And again, it speaks to what you addressed earlier. It's not simple solutions. I mean, all aquariums are not bad. All aquariums don't treat people the same way. And it's tough to, you can't paint everything with the same brush, if you ask me. So it really speaks to that point. And then I wanted to talk about, you know, you have... specifically, you started in Seafood Watch started in 1999, correct? As a way to help get people make choices. So, how does your science, you know, the science that you do, isn't that the underpinning to help support some of the most sustainable seafood programs around the world? Does that make sense? There's so much science that goes on at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. That's the point that I wanted to make.
Yeah, and I think that's probably the part that most people know least about.
Because I agree.
It's a bit of a wonky message, right, that we have recommendations for 1,300 fisheries and farms across the world, things like that. That's a little much for people to take on. But what we have done originally, I think, because we're just a scientific-based organization, our founder is a scientist, and that is in the lifeblood of who the Monterey Bay Aquarium is, and therefore Seafood Watch as well, but also because at the beginning, we were often butting heads with industry. And so our armor, if you will, our defense was everything we do is peer-reviewed science, and the process is completely transparent. If you have a problem with it, we're happy to discuss it. Please bring your cited research, and we're happy to have a scientific conversation about it.
Right.
And that nipped a lot of arguments in the bud. But we've then, that science, our science, has become the bedrock of the sustainable seafood movement overall. So even if you're on the East Coast and you're looking at other scientific programs, if you're a business and you're not necessarily a partner with us, maybe you're partnering with Fishwise, which is an organization that businesses know but the public might not necessarily know, those groups use our science. We provide that to everyone free of charge so that they can spread the message. Again, it's very much like the model we have with zoos and aquariums. So you might be buying fish at a place, well, let's say like Safeway, where they are not a Seafood Watch partner, but their commitment to sustainable seafood through another nonprofit organization is based on our science. So those are other ways that we support the movement overall.
And I have to ask you about a person, and I didn't do my research, but I thought about what a happy memory she is and how I smile when I think of her face and how welcome she made me feel. Is Jen Kemmerly still there?
Yes, that is. Jen is my boss. She is still amazing. And she, you know, that she really has become the face of the organization, I mean, has always been, but as we move more into this, the international space, as we start to work with, you know, Southeast Asia, China, all these places we've mentioned earlier in our conversation, Jen's at the UN. She's speaking on panels with John Kerry. She's everywhere. And so that she really is sort of the face of this newly evolved Seafood Watch.
And just please promise me on air for the thousands of listeners that will hear this show that you promise me you'll tell her that I said hello and what happy memories I have of all of my interactions with her.
Well, you got me. I'm on air, so yeah, please. I promise.
That's right. That's great. We can't pinky swear because we're not together, but I think it's really incredible. Do you want to foray at all into your thoughts or the stand that the aquarium is taking in terms of, you know, I feel as though the current administration, as much as I'd like to keep the show apolitical, it's getting harder and harder given the things that come out daily about the environment and our state, you know, our national parks and the EPA and on and on. Do you have concerns about the impact that they can have on some of the work you're doing and the shape of our oceans? Or you just say, you know, keep looking forward and keep doing the work you're doing. Would you like to comment on that at all? I don't want to put you on the spot, but it's...
No, I can comment on that, sure. You know, we being the Aquarium and Seafood Watch, are putting more and more effort into our policy work. And we are more and more seen, at least within the United States, as states, as being the leaders. States, municipalities.
Yes.
So a lot of our focus has moved to that. How do we get local government, again, state, regional level, rather than national level, to lead on these issues? How do we interact then on the international stage with governments who are interested in this work? So the field has changed. I think your listeners will understand exactly what I mean there. It has changed quite a bit, but we are still pushing forward, just choosing our partners with great care and moving forward on a lot of things. And particularly because we're in California, we're very excited to see California stepping forward as a leader on so many of these issues that are at the heart of the soul of ocean issues.
Well, you can see a little bit where having the national headquarters in Arizona puts me a little bit in a bad mood occasionally. So we're not. My daughter lives in California, and when we're over there, she goes, "Mom, please don't tell people you're from Arizona." But and friends of mine say, "Why do you bash Arizona?" I mean, I live in the blue part of the state where there are so many sustainable things going on, and Desert Museum, and we're a city of gastronomy, and the University of Arizona, and biosphere. I mean, the beat goes on. So I live in a very happy place here. But there is the reality of some of the very few, you know, the minority who happen to get elected. And the good that will come of it is you got to the heart of it. States as leaders. And I think that is one of the things that we're all going to continue to comment on, focus on, and become active in. Because states, we're not victims. We have a lot of power, and we just have to start exercising it in ways we might not have in the past. Two things before we, you know, just time so flies when we have a great guest like you. But what about, you mentioned it a little bit, but I'd like to talk about it a little bit more. And it was basically because of this person I heard yesterday that really is on the top of the social media world. Does the word millennial come up in your conversations about shaping what you're doing? Because they are a new face. They are different. They don't read emails. You know, they don't do this, they don't do that, they don't do this. And there are millions of them, and they are shaping our economy. Does that come up as a conversation? Where are the millennials in your long-range planning, which is now about 3 years for all of us?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say the first thing I did is I sort of cheated, and I just hired one.
And, oh my God! No, that is the perfect answer. That is not cheating. How do they think? Where are they spending time? Yes, that's brilliant.
And you know, when I started this job, I was personally doing the social media, but I have since moved that over.
You were probably a millennial. You may still be.
I'm right on the cusp. Yeah. my new employee is definitely a millennial, and he's teaching me a lot. And I think, You know, I have high hopes. I think a lot of times millennials get a bad rap. I think the fact that they are so in tune with their devices makes it that much easier for me to get my message out.
Yes, yes.
There are challenges, of course, but we can overcome them.
I don't want to give them a bad rap at all. I really don't. I'm watching them and I'm learning from them. The only thing I'm pretty standing firm on with, you know, my granddaughter, who's one, no, I'm not doing Snapchat. You cannot make me do Snapchat. It's just, there's some things that are just generationally inappropriate, and grandma on Snapchat is one of them, if you ask me, so I'm not doing that. In our closing minutes, give us some calls to action and really the ways, the most meaningful ways to stay in touch with you and connected. Tell us, direct us, because I have really great listeners around the country and they are engaged and they do respond to calls to action. So talk to us about that.
Sure. So I'd say the lowest bar is make sure you have an app or a pocket guide and make sure that you are, if possible, supporting the businesses that have made commitments to sustainable seafood.
Love it.
Now, I mentioned earlier, they might be direct partners with us. They might not be. There are businesses with sustainable seafood commitments who, again, are using our science or someone else's science, but they've made some sort of commitment, and we need to reward that. If you're not sure, just ask the question, do you sell sustainable seafood? At the very least, at that point, you're putting that in their mind, that is something you're interested in. That one question, because I know your audience, they're listening to you, they're obviously interested and they know more than others. That one question isn't going to change the world, but it is going to help. It is going to be another drop in the bucket of this movement, and the movement is moving forward. So that's something. If you want to go to that next step, if you want to be more involved, if you're already shopping at partners, you're already asking questions, then up your questions a little bit. Where was this fish caught? What exactly is species is this fish? You know, if you get the fish and chips, it's good to know what's in it. How was it caught? Those are questions to ask. If I'm lucky enough to have some business owners on this, you know, listening to this, consider partnership. If you sell any sustainable seafood items or seafood items of any kind, reach out to us, and we would be more than happy to get you on as a partner. And then, last but not least, look for us on social media. If this is something you're interested in, we're on all the major platforms. You can find us. We have our own blog, Facebook, of course. Instagram, Twitter, et cetera. So do look for us there. And know that even though sustainable seafood can often feel overwhelming, it doesn't have to be. We're there to help you with that.
It doesn't have to be. And what I'm going to say is, you know, one of the things that I've been doing recently, if there's a membership, become a member. Even if you're not going there, become a member. And I do what I call my small tithing to numerous organizations. If, you know, $10 a month may not seem like much out of someone's budget, but if 1,000 people are doing $10 a month, it starts to become, you know, so much more significant to cash flow. The work that you do costs so much money. And I'm just going to say that. I mean, the scientific research, the collaboration, the travel, the events that you put on, they all are funded. They cost money, and you're a nonprofit that has to make a profit to stay in business. So I will boldly say to people, if you're looking for another cause and there's room in your budget, that's another really good way that you can support this amazing organization. And if you haven't been to the Monterey Bay Aquarium, just put it on your bucket list. It's one of the happiest times and most wonderful memories for me as a parent that we got to do with all of our children and my grandchildren. I mean, it's a magical place. And I mean it when I say I like it way more than Disneyland. And I might be a minority, but man, it's so much more fun and just interactive. And the area surrounding it is also amazing. So that's great. And before we get off the air, I do want to talk about the shows that we have coming up, because we're doing a great one of our local show, Down to Earth with Mrs. Green. It's with Dan Hogan from Tucson Electric Power, Operation Weatherization. And it doesn't matter if it's, you know, focused on at-risk populations, marginally employed, low income, but it's really about weatherization so that you can weatherize your house to consume less energy. And then we are going to have a best of show. Mrs. Green is taking some much needed time off, and we're going to have our friend Layla Salazar from Amazon Watch talking about the conditions of the rainforest, which, as my regular listeners know, is where I began my journey. So Ryan Bigelow what a delightful way for me to spend an hour. And I hope you feel like I do, that the time really did fly, because to me, it's like, what? I'm getting the 2-minute warning already. So thank you. Thanks for the work you do. Thanks for taking an hour, and give my best to Jen.
I will. Thank you so much.
Make it a great green week, everybody.